Hitler if you think we're on the run.
Hello and welcome to episode 22 of the Dad's Army Podcast.
We are the boys who will make you think again.
Now, the observant amongst you will have already detected that I have a cold. I will therefore try and keep my voice on this podcast to an absolute minimum. Fortunate, really, as what's coming up is primarily many of the stars of Dad's Army. These are the recordings I made at the Dad's Army Appreciation Society members' meal on Saturday the 10th of May. This was shortly after the locations tour that featured in episode 21 of the podcast. So coming up, you'll hear from David Croft, Jimmy Perry, Pamela Cundell, Harold Snowd, and Michael Knowles. One thing I would like to say before we get into the main part of this podcast, and that's completely unrelated, but it's to talk about feedback. Now, just to let you know how many people we've got listening to the podcast, we've got just over 5,000 subscribers worldwide, and that for me is fantastic, and it's the main thing, is that you've got people out there listening to the podcast. However, our feedback rate has really deteriorated. We're only getting one or two emails now each month, and I've said it in the past, your feedback and your thoughts and your views really make this podcast come alive. So if you've never sent us an email before, then please send us one. My email address, as I'm sure you know, because I talk about it all the time, is james@dadsarmypodcast.com. If you don't want to actually send us an email, then there are other ways you can leave your thoughts about each podcast. If you go onto the podcast page, which is dadsarmy.podomatic.com, you can click on the word comments and you can leave your thoughts about that particular podcast on the webpage for all to see. Lastly, if you listen to us via iTunes, we've only got 6 reviews on iTunes. It would be really great to have a few more reviews. Now, I realise that's a double-edged sword because, of course, people can leave bad reviews as well, but I'm prepared to stick my neck out and say, please be completely honest, go onto the podcast page in the iTunes store and leave your comments. There you are, that's it for me. That's enough of me going on about feedback. So, without any further ado, we'll get straight into the recordings I made last week.
You're listening to the Dad's Army Podcast with your host, James.
Pamela Cundell.
Friends, every year, somebody will come up and say, hello, next year I see them again, and it's made me very happy. And I really have to thank the one person, and I will tell this story because I always tell it, that how I came to be Mrs. Fox. I was doing a sitcom, something with Ian Carmichael, and I was just in this episode, and I had to be a fortune teller. And at the very end of the episode, I looked into the camera and said, all things will come right in the end.
Pamela gives her trademark wink.
And it happened that David was in the audience, because in those days we used to do recordings and producers used to come in. They wanted somebody to go, Mr. Jones, have you got any sausages?
Pamela winks again.
And I qualified.
Very good.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, David. And it's really been wonderful. Darlings, I love you.
Harold Snowd.
It's always very difficult on these occasions because, I mean, thankfully this has been going for such a long time. It's lovely to come back over and over again, but obviously you're talking to a great extent to the same audience that was listened to you before, you know. So I do apologise if some of the things I'm going to say, you know, you've actually heard before, obviously. My connection with the show, and I was very lucky to be working with David, for whom I have a great deal to thank over the years, was when I started off working on this programme as the production manager, which made me find all the locations. And somebody said, I think earlier, that to a great extent, it is because this I found the locations in this area that we are here, and it has worked out very well. Who would have thought that 40 years ago we started a series which would take off as well as it did? I mean, we knew we had great faith in it from the word go, but there are very few programmes, let's face it, that keep as long as this. And I think certainly the stuff that we've put on in the last 10 or 12 years, we're very lucky if they last 40 days or 40 years. It was a great joy to work on and find the locations. I narrowed it down because I wanted to find an area As I say, if any of you heard this before, I apologise. I wanted to find an area that we could take control of for doing what was, even when we did it 40 years ago, was a period piece. We didn't want to be in an area where you've got modern, in quotes, because it's not modern cars, but even so, it was 30 years later, you know, driving around, and we wanted to, we could have control over it. And therefore, I decided that I would look for a military area, and this area came up and worked it terribly well. Not only because we had the place to ourselves, but there were a certain number of properties, because it had been taken over by the army, that were still there, houses, churches, this sort of thing, prior to them being blown up every so often. But they were there, and it proved to be, I think, very well, very good. And then, of course, that was next door to Thetford, and I walked around Thetford, and immediately I could see what we wanted in certain streets in Thetford that were sort of, in fact, if you go down them now, they're still stuck in a sort of time warp, and you think, my God, yes, you know, you could tell nothing's changed from A, those days, and you know, B, now, nothing's changed at all. So from that point of view, it was very handy to have this particular area, or that particular area, I suppose we're a few miles away from it now, as a location base. It was very handy indeed. It was a wonderful series. The team spirit between everybody was superb. Everybody got on very well indeed. There were a few little nudges between two or three more senior members of the cast, possibly resented a certain person getting a chair on location when they didn't, or something. But on the whole, it was very happy team. And a certain number of wives and families used to come down at the weekend. It was absolutely marked. And we also had this fantastic weather. I mean, I can remember a couple of occasions, probably more, but I don't think of that anymore, when we did have the odd day's rain or something. But on the whole, I mean, this thing about Croft weather was so right. I mean, we were so lucky. We always had wonderful weather, which made life a lot easier. Again, I don't know how long I'm going to do, but just relate a few anecdotes. One of the things about the Stanford Patton training areas, I used to meet up with the chap in charge, a chap called Colonel Cleesby Thompson, every day and discuss what we were going to do the following day's filming, and he was a great fan of what we were doing anyway, but I always put him in the picture, as it were. And there was one particular sequence, which is the show where Pike gets caught in this bog and sinks lower and lower into this. And obviously you can't just do that sort of filming in a real bog, it's very dangerous and all the rest of it, and you don't have as much control over it as you want to doing the filming over what might be 3 or 4 hours. And so I suddenly hit upon this idea that running through the middle of the training area was a river, and there was sort of sluice gates either side, and I discovered that if you actually adjusted those, you could raise the water level, so it went over the edge of the river, over the surrounding grass, both sort of 2 or 3 pitch, football pitch sizes, shall we say, and could be limited to a couple of inches. So for all intents and purposes, once you'd actually dug a specific sort of 6-foot hole in there, which Pipe was going to go down, and we put in various rostrum in that, so that at first he was only down, and we had a 6-foot hole, but then we had a 4-foot rostrum in it, so he was only down 2 foot. And then as it got worse, we lowered the rostrum so it was down a bit further, that sort of thing, and we threw a little bit of cork on the water and all the rest of it, and it worked extremely well. And I discussed all this with the CO, and he said, yeah, that's absolutely fine, yeah, okay, do that. And David will remember this. The filming went very well indeed. I'll refer a little bit aspect of it in a minute. And we went back the next day. When I went to see this Colonel Cleesby Thompson the next morning, he wasn't particularly pleased. And I soon found out why that was. But unbeknown to me, I didn't realise this, but he had this dog, and he used to walk his dog around these fields at night, or at least towards dusk, as it were. And he wore sort of army boots, and if he was in 2 inches of water, it didn't worry him terribly, so he went into tight boots. Until, of course, he found this bloody great hole. And he and the dog disappeared down this hole. And he wasn't very pleased. Because I don't know when he thought we were going to fill it in. We were going to fill it in the next day, but we certainly couldn't fill it in after finished filming that day. It was too big a job. And also, we wanted, really, the water to go back into the river. So I remember coming back to David and said, I think we've fallen out with the CO, and told him why. And he agreed with me it would be a very good idea if we asked the CO and his wife to dinner at the Bell that night, which we did, and it all went very well. Which brings me on just a little bit to some of the impracticalities of certain actors. And one of the people, I mean, I loved every member of the cast, we all did, but a particular man who was extremely impractical was John the Measurer. I mean, he really was terribly impractical. And, I mean, the first time I ever experienced that was when he said, when I said to him one day when we were on vacation, said, John, your watch has stopped. And he said, oh, hello. Can you wind it up for me? But after that, we began to realise how impractical he was. And in this particular sequence, this rescuing pipe from this bog, we just knew that if he was got involved in it in any way at all, it would go completely out of the wall. It just couldn't work because he was really impractical. Which is why I think I'm right in saying, Jimmy, David and Jimmy, that it was written, the fact that he got caught on some wire netting on the way to rescue him. So he was the only person who couldn't get off and any assistance at all. From that point of view, he was very impractical, but a lovely man. I experienced the same thing a few years later when I produced and directed the Dick Emery series for 8 years, and I had a scene on location with John at one end of a big double bed, and there's Dick in the bed. And John had this scene where he had to hold this revolver and point the revolver at Dick and say, give me the bracelet, give me the bracelet. And we were just rehearsing this, and the camera's off there, it was on two shots, Dick on one side and John on the other. And he said, Harold, he said, just a minute. So I'm holding this revolver, how am I going to take the bracelet? And I said, John, use your other hand. He went, oh yeah. But all in all, they were an absolutely lovely cast. We thoroughly enjoyed ourselves. There was one other quick experience I'll tell you about when we were filming back on Stanford Practical Training Area, and we were at stables and whatnot, and we were in the middle of sort of filming or something, and suddenly, out of the undergrowth, a man stood up in full camouflage outfit and said, we're going to blow this place up in 10 minutes. And I said, no, you can't, because it was part of the Stanford Practical Training Area, so I mean, it's the sort of thing they did do. But I said, hang on, we're filming here, and the CEO knows that we're filming here. And he said, does he? So I said, yes, of course he does. So he said, oh, well, we were told to blow it up. So I said, well, can you hang on a second? So I got on the walkie-talkie to Colonel Teasby Thompson, and I said, listen to him. So he said, right, okay, fine. So then he turned and he said, okay, then he said, well, we'll come back and blow it up tomorrow. And he says, all right, lads, off we go. And none of us had known. There were about 50 other people, all in the undergrowth. We all just stood up and walked off. Extraordinary, you know. But, it was great fun. I just wanted to know, I just see whether, in fact, I've left anything out. Probably not. There was also one little scene where we filmed with Mannering, left hanging over the railway bridge, remember, dangling from the railway bridge. And I had actually confirmed with the British Rail, or the equivalent was in those days, that there would be no train coming down that particular thing between some set of time and some set of time. And yes, they'd agreed, no train at all. Okay, fine. So we're there shooting that particular day, and lo and behold, we've got this all set up and whatnot, Mannering's over the edge and what have you, and coming down the line towards us is a train. So I dashed down off the bridge and I'm standing in the middle of this line and stop, and the train stops, and it turns out to be that it wasn't a proper, well, it was a train, but it wasn't a train actually with passengers on it, it was weed killing. But nobody told him, so if we hadn't stopped it we might have had a lot of trouble near the bridge, you know? But, it was alright. And the last thing I just say, purely out of interest for those fans of the series, the episode where Jones is caught up on a windmill and goes round and round on the windmill. That was an out-of-work windmill. It didn't actually work. It was my idea to use it. But if you look at it again, you will see below on the ground, in front of the windmill, a little hut. And that little hut we put there, and what happens is there's a couple of scene boys behind, and they are standing there, and every time the windmill goes around, they do that. They're the ones that are actually operating the power in it. And we got away with it. It worked perfectly well indeed. But, I mean, we can't fault A, the cast, B, the writers, and David Croft, I mean, his production. He let me direct 9 episodes as well. It was wonderful, and it's wonderful to be associated with what has turned out to be such a marvellous success.
Michael Knowles.
I always feel vaguely presumptuous talking about Dead Zone because I was only in, six episodes. And yet, everyone sort of remembers that fact. And I've always put other people who have done so much more. Can I tell you perhaps how I started in Dead Zone? I was in Jimmy Perry's rep in Watford. And the rep closed. And Jimmy started to write Dead Zone, in fact. And Linda would have told you, she was working at Westminster Theatre, she used to pop in for tea, and Jimmy would say, I've got this brilliant idea for a series. And then I would pop in for the Labour Exchange, because I would have worked, a cup of coffee. Jimmy would rush up, say, what do you think of this, old boy? I think it might work. And that was the start, I suppose, of Dad's Army. And I'll be fairly brief with this. And Jimmy then took it, he said, I'm going to take this to David Croft, because I know his... And his wife is my agent, so I'm going to get it put in. He showed it to David, and he came back and he said, I've written this episode. He said, I'm going to try and get you a part if I can. He said, you must remember, I was in rep with Jimmy, and in rep you played anything, no matter how old you were, who the character was. And he said, it's a 70-year-old Colonel Wilkinson, I think, General Wilkinson. He's about 70 odd, he said. You can do it, boy. Just tell the part and then you're all right. He did suggest it to David, and I didn't get the part, actually.
You're all of 20.
He did suggest it later, and David very graciously cast me as my first episode, which was one of the lost episodes, I think, which is the Lones of Long Distance Walker, in which I played Captain Cut. I've been reflecting. How much work I've done for David. I think I hold the record for the number of things I've... Movies, television, stage, writing, several... Ain't Half Hot Mummy, Rainbow Lord, Come Back Mrs. Noah, Orson. Yes. It works out about 12 or 13 things. I think I must hold the record. Can I just say, if it hadn't been for Jimmy and for David, they gave me my career, really. So all I can say is I owe them a great, great debt of gratitude. Thank you so much.
David Croft.
All, particularly members of the programmes in the old days, you're all looking fabulous. Great to see you alive. Or half alive. I do remember one thing about John Romero, since we're talking about him. From time to time, you were in all the gear, belts, the rifles, an enormous amount of stuff. And every time I say cut, he'd undo his belt and the whole thing would fall on the floor. Of course, this was chaos as far as the armourers were concerned, because he could get the little shells out of the barrel. Yes. So, you know, he was a bit of a dangerous person to have on vacation. It's great to see you all. I don't go on, as you probably know. But thank you all for being here, and hope to see you next year.
Jimmy Perry.
Well, thank you, so charming and grateful tonight. I don't know what to say next. It's very difficult. As I came in, he said, oh, we're going on before David Croft. That was my first mistake. Anyhow, never mind. As I look around this room, thanks for your support, everybody. And I look around for some inspiration of something to say. And as I turn my eyes towards the table at the back there, there's an actor named Talvrin Thomas.
Jimmy's referring to a photo.
Very funny man. Was most unpopular with the cast. And towards the end of the series, John Laurie came to me and said, James, yon Welsh fella, is he going to be in the next series? I said, oh no. He said, get rid of him, he's too funny. One has to tell the truth. Thank you, David. little thing here that not many of you know, that David and I, during the last war, was that the one that is the last war?
Last we remember, anyway.
We both served in the Royal Artillery. I didn't find any, we didn't know each other until many, many years later. And I found out that David had been a major and I was a sergeant. And that's 40 years we went on like that. Nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. He's still the major and I'm the sergeant. Be all right, David. We'll get used to it. Thank you, everyone.
I'm joined now by one of the founders of Dad's Army. I had the great honour of speaking to David Crofts.
Hello.
Hello, David. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So let me ask you, if you were to go into the commissioning office of the BBC today with Dad's Army, how soon do you think it would be on our screens?
I don't think it would get there. You never know. Funny things happen. In those days, I had no trouble in getting shows placed at all. If I think the executives those days have all started life in the theatre and were more sort of entrepreneurs than they are now.
Are you surprised at how long the legacy has lasted?
I'm delighted. I think you don't set out to write a flop, but nobody ever visualised success. I think they expected to run for 13 programmes.
13? Yeah. Wow, incredible. Yeah. So we're approaching the 40th anniversary now, and you must have been asked this question hundreds and hundreds of times already. Yeah. Have you got a favourite episode?
I think Mum's Army was my favourite episode, really. We're lucky to have it because it was one of the lost ones, and I found it in Australia.
Really?
Yes, and managed to get them to send it back to us, and about seven more programmes that they had. The BBC sort of in Australia had them in a vault.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, and I didn't know that. Yeah. I have to admit, Mum's Army is one of my favourites as well. You just get to see a completely different side to the actors. Yeah, yeah. No, it's fantastic. I've seen the stage show now, the recent touring stage show, many times. Yeah. What's it like actually watching some different actors fill some iconic roles?
Well, it's different, of course, obviously, but I think it's interesting, really, because they've all made their own versions of the characters, really, and it's worked.
It's done remarkably well. Yeah. It's been touring for nearly a year now, and plans for an extension as well. So
yes,
it's a wonderful testament and introducing Dad's Army to a whole new audience.
Yes, and a young audience, too. I mean, some of our biggest fans these days are around about 9 to 15.
Indeed, some of our listeners to the podcast are the same age. Yeah. It's wonderful that it appeals across the ages.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, David, thank you very much indeed for spending just a few minutes speaking to me. It's been great. Thank you
very much.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
I'm joined now by Stephen Griffiths, who lectures on TV history at Staffordshire University. So could you tell us a little bit about how you got into talking about Dad's Army for a living?
I'm a fan to begin with, and as a result of that, it just basically developed into the kinds of things I like talking about, and I'm interested in particular. I'm particularly interested in all British comedy, really, and in particular things like Dad's Army and the Croft and Perry shows in particular, because I think that they are such important pieces, really, that do tend to get overlooked, really, within the mass of comedy that's available today. And I think without a doubt, some of the work that Croft and Perry were doing was without a doubt shaping British comedy, the very nature of British comedy and so on. But as well being very much linked to the traditions of British comedy as well, kind of the end of the pier, seaside fun and entertainment and so on. So I mean, it's very, very important in that sense. And obviously a link back to music hall as well.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's all very, very important.
So it's absolutely everything. It's the impact it has on television today. Do you talk about the production of it in any way?
Not so much, yeah, I mean, we talk a little bit about kind of the production values and so on that were involved in those days. And I was talking about this quite earlier on, in the sense that it does seem quite outdated, shows like Dad's Army, for viewers to watch today. And it's a case, really, of just making students aware that there are links, that it does have a history, without a doubt. It's very much an important part of TV and its development. And, in order to be able to appreciate TV today, you have to look back at the past and what was being developed by people like Croft and Perry.
absolutely. No, it sounds like a fascinating subject.
Yeah,
Had I been gone to university, that's certainly a subject I would have looked at.
I mean, it's all very, very new, isn't it? I mean, it's not the kind of thing that people would expect to be taught at university. But, I mean, the courses I'm involved in, we do look at the history, we look at the theoretical, the critical side of TV, but also on the practical side, and we very much believe that the two are interlinked. Mm. And in order for students to go on to perhaps work in TV or the film industry, they need to have a knowledge of what's gone before. They need to be aware of the context in which they're working and the tried and tested formats that have gone again and again. Because there's no such thing as a new idea. It's a case of developing and borrowing ideas and so on. So, yeah.
Certainly. So what's it like actually meeting and speaking to the individuals whose work you discuss?
It's great, really. I mean, I'm very interested in TV actors anyway, so it's always very nice to meet them and also the writers and the creative teams as well. I think more often than not, you know, the actors, they tend to take the limelight. I think we need to look at people like Croft and Perry and Harold Snow that's here, you know, as well today, and sort of be aware of the impact that they had. Because if it wasn't for the writing, then the show wouldn't exist.
Yeah, that's very true, and there's so many programmes, certainly of bygone eras, where you simply haven't got access to a lot of the stars, the production crew, as you have with Dad's Army.
That's and it's quite nice. And also, as well, there's so many links to other shows. You know, it's a bit like the kind of the Rock family tree, in the sense that, you know, they're all very much built on each other and so on. So it's quite nice in that as well.
Terrific. Well, thank you very much indeed, Steve,
no
for
problem.
Spending a few
Cheers.
Minutes talking
That's
to
okay.
us.
That's okay. Great stuff.
That's it for episode 22. Hope you really enjoyed listening to what the stars had to say. We'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with episode 23. It may be a little bit more than 2 weeks this time. It depends on a number of things that I'm going to have to do in the real world, as opposed to just talking about one of my favourite television programmes. However, in episode 23, we'll be talking a little bit about the test, and hopefully we'll also be talking a little bit how Bressingham 2008 went this year. Don't forget to send us some emails and leave us your feedback on the webpage, james@dadsarmypodcast.com, and I look forward to speaking to you in a couple of weeks' time. You have been listening to episode 22 of the Dad's Army Podcast with your host, James. The Dad's Army Podcast is free to download. The owners make absolutely no commercial gain from it whatsoever. We produce the podcast purely out of our affection for the programme. No infringements of any kind intended.